again, fellow travellers, and welcome to podcast 187 in our series, You Should Have Been There, with me, Simon Calder.
And me, Mick Webb. And today's guest is not only extremely well-travelled, but has also written a book of thoughtful recollections and musings on those travels. And it's entitled The Travelling Ape. So a very warm welcome to Mike Richards. And for starters, Mike, how many of the world's countries have you actually visited?
Well, thanks. It's great to be with you both. Last time I checked, I'd been to 155 countries. And on the UN definition, there are 195 countries in the world. So about 80% of the countries I've been to at this stage.
And from reading your book, it's clear that you've done more than just touch down in a transit lounge or indeed pop across the frontier to get a passport stamp and a selfie before hurrying on to the next destination.
Yeah, there's this thing about sort of, I guess, country collecting, some people call it, and it can be quite transactional in some situations, I think. But I've probably spent about 5 or 6 years of my life traveling, and this is, I'm able to work remotely for the last 5 years, so I can base myself wherever I want in the world as I travel. And it's about sort of exploring the culture, exploring each place, and doing more than certainly going to the airport doesn't count. I think for each country you need to, you know, stay ideally for a few days at least. There's some micro states that would be hard to stay in, like the Vatican, for example. I don't think you can actually stay there. So, you know, a few hours there is probably fine. But for other countries, really, you want to stay long enough to see a few of the major cities and sites and get a feel for the place.
We'll find out much more in just a moment, Mike. But in the time-honoured tradition of You Should Have Been There, we've now got to ask you kindly to bear with us for a couple of minutes while we bring people up to date on recent communications from our listeners, starting with this from Kim, who was replying to our request for adventurous travel experiences. She says, interrailing across Europe last year. Exhausting for a couple of novice older travellers, but great for seeing so many places in one go, favourites being Slovenia and Budapest.
Oh, well, I agree with Slovenia, and it does show that actually, you know, one person's normal kind of experience is another person's adventure. But we've also got some more results from our recent poll about alcohol being served on flights. Should it be banned was the question, and a third of respondents agreed that it should be, while two-thirds thought it shouldn't. Is this something that bothers you, Mike, drinking on planes?
Not particularly. So I don't actually drink. I sort of stopped drinking a few years ago, but I think when I did used to drink, it was something I enjoyed every now and then, so I feel like it should be personal choice. But you know, I've been on certain flights where you see sort of some people take it a little bit too far. And in those situations, yeah, perhaps some kind of limit maybe would be a good compromise.
And there's no drinking on coaches, whether or not they're electric, which is what I've been doing this week. I took the first battery-powered intercity bus in Britain from Bristol to London. I rather enjoyed it, although it did take twice as long as the part diesel, part electric trains between Bristol and London. And I wondered, would the wider world consider it? Geraldine said, only if I had no money and I desperately needed to get to Bristol. And Sarah added, no, I wouldn't. I would use the bus more if they were reliable, better routes, cheaper, cleaner and safer. Sadly, they are currently none of that. I must say, Sarah, I would disagree. But she continues, even the closest bus station isn't a safe place to be thanks to thugs who like to cause trouble.
Oh, well, Charlotte Baker says, great to see Flixbus innovating in this way and sounds like it's a much nicer ride without diesel judders. We had an electric coach to transport our wedding guests between the church and venue, but it wasn't easy to find. Colin P, though, is less enthused. I might consider travelling by bus if they were available as an option, but I'm not interested in whether they're powered by fossil fuels, sunlight, or fairy dust.
Well, of course, we're always keen to know about your favourite forms of propulsion, from fossil fuels to fairy dust. You can tweet us at YouShouldHaveBT or send us a voice message. Just go to anchor.fm/YouShouldHaveBeenThere and follow the instructions.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for your patience, and let's get on to our main course, your book, The Travelling Ape. And I suppose a good place to start is the title. I thought at first it might be a comment on the holiday behaviour of some of us UK travellers, even in planes, as we mentioned earlier. But it's actually a lot more significant than that, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a bit of a play on the idea that, we are, at a base level, all of us are apes, and we sort of began in Africa, and then we are this species of ape that, travelled around the world, roaming into Europe and then across Asia and eventually into the Americas. And I guess it was a bit of a play on that view that actually, when you're travelling now, we're still all just travelling apes. And fortunately, we live now in a world where, we can see in, a lifetime so much more than, past generations were able to see. And I think we're really the first generation in history that, we can circumnavigate the globe in a day. If you have the means to buy the plane ticket, you can travel to Australia in, 20 hours in a trip that would have taken you months by sea. And for most of human history, you would have grown up in an area and you might have sort of roamed around that area, but it was unlikely that you would have gone to a different country, and certainly that you would have seen different continents. And so we live in this really special, I think, unique time where we have the ability to see so much of the world. And that's kind of what drove the idea with the title.
And you actually end the book by saying, in being born, you were given the staggering opportunity of briefly living on this planet. Don't spend your life vegetating in a little corner of it. What was it that triggered this enterprising mission or quest to visit so many countries and meet so many people? Was it perhaps to counter the negative view of the world that maybe your job as a risk analyst had given you?
Yeah, potentially. I think, I always enjoyed travel sort of growing up, and I found maybe when I was in my early 20s, I saw a scratch map somewhere and was like, oh, I've already been to 50 countries. Let's see if I can get to 100, just because it's sort of having the goal forces you to go to places that traditional holiday makers wouldn't think about visiting. And once I got to 100, I was like, well, I'm over halfway now, so I may as well keep going. And I think what's been really nice about the journey is actually some of the best destinations or the most interesting experiences have been to countries that, I wouldn't have gone to unless I was trying to visit as many countries as possible. I would think about the countries in Central Asia, for example, which are absolutely astounding, but are not on most people's travel itineraries. I've been to places like North Korea, Venezuela, Iraq, again, places that are not sort of featuring high on people's travel itineraries. But actually being forced to see lots of the world for myself, what I learn, and this is such a common thing among people that travel, is that actually the stories that we read at home in the media and that we see on the television paint this picture of the world as a dangerous, scary, unsafe place full of malevolent people and suffering. And there's certainly problems in the world. But my feeling, the more countries I visited, was actually that the world is much better than we give it credit for. 99% of people are good people. And even in countries that we perceive to be, scary or dangerous, you go there and actually most people are overwhelmingly kind, friendly, and welcoming.
Yeah, well, sort of case in point, really. One of the places you've visited and write about is Rwanda. Now, that is actually very much in the news at the moment with, I suppose you could call it in a political way, with one side of the argument, viz. Our government, trying to paint it as a marvellous place, and detractors and indeed quite a lot of other people suggesting that actually it is something of a police state and not a very nice place to live if you happen to disagree with the government. Now, what was your experience of it?
My experience of Rwanda, it was about 5 years ago that I visited. I was generally very impressed by the country. I think it's one of the fastest growing economies in the world and certainly has been in Africa for the last few years. It was spotlessly clean. They have a thing called Umuganda, where they all, I think every month, everyone has to clean up their local community and clean up the streets. And it's sort of a community exercise in building trust between the communities, but also obviously making the place look nicer. So I was impressed, but I also knew that, the president, Paul Kagame, there are definitely question marks over the human rights record and sort of authoritarian tendencies of his government. But again, if you look at Africa as a whole, a lot of the countries there are struggling with different issues. And I've been to probably half of the countries in Africa. And I would say that, you know, there's degrees of authoritarianism all over the continent. There is some definitely in Rwanda, but at least in this case, they do appear to be pushing things in the right direction. And Rwanda is a beautiful country, really lovely people. The scenery is incredible. And it's somewhere as well where you can, one of the few, I think you can only see mountain gorillas in Rwanda, Uganda, and Congo, just in a tiny area on the border between those three countries. So that was the reason I visited, really. But I left, I think quite impressed with how the country was run.
Let's look more widely, if we may, at your book. I'm interested in the reasons that you you postulate for why we travel. I suppose some of them are pretty obvious: education, escapism, connection, weather. But you also say there's two different kinds of fun. Do explain how that works, Mike.
Okay, so you have your normal fun, which is just a fun experience at the time, and you make nice memories, and you know, you take them home with you. But I think a big part of travel, and I can't remember where I heard the phrase first, but it's always stuck with me. It's called type 2 fun. Type 2 fun is an experience you have on the road, which objectively is not fun and is bad, essentially. So it could be your plans going wrong, or your car breaking down in the middle of the desert, or you getting ill somewhere with food poisoning and you having to find a way to, you know, the local hospital. And it's experiences at the time you think, wow, this is, I'm out of my comfort zone. This is really difficult. You know, I would rather be at home right now. But strangely enough, all of these experiences are the ones that I look back on kind of most fondly, or at least you have sort of great anecdotes coming out from it. So I think in the book I talked about a trip to Israel where me and two friends, we were down by the Red Sea and we went for a swim. And when we got back to our car, all of our belongings had been stolen. And we had literally just, so we just had our swimming trunks and our bags gone with our passports and absolutely everything. So we had to drive back to Tel Aviv, a 4-hour drive, just wearing our swimming trunks. And then sort of plodded into the British Embassy, again, just wearing swimming trunks, saying, okay, we have absolutely nothing. Can we find a way to get home, please? And fortunately, our mums collectively helped get us home. And at the time, we were gutted. We lost all the pictures of the trip. We lost, you know, valuable goods, although in the end, insurance paid for it. But I think when that was all sorted out, this trip was 15 years ago, and we still laugh about it to this day. And we did lots of great stuff on that trip. But actually, in some ways, that is a thing that, you know, stands out as a highlight in some ways. So I always try and remember this when I'm traveling in places where, when things appear to be going wrong, when you're delayed or things are taking longer than expected, instead of trying to fight it, just being like, okay, this is the reason why you're here in some ways, is to be out of your comfort zone in a new place. You know, there's uncertainty, there's some challenges, but actually it's how you deal with them that actually are some of the best stories. This is where the type 2 fun thing, I think, can be very helpful.
Type 2 fun. Yeah, I like the idea of that. But Mike, your overwhelming message in the book is one of, I suppose you could call it, positivity, seeing the best side of people and places, but you are not averse to putting the boot in at times. Do tell us about Port Moresby, for instance.
Yeah, so this is the capital of Papua New Guinea, and I had been warned by a couple of people I knew that had been. They were like, this is one of the most dangerous cities in the world. And one of the companies I work for, the Economist Intelligence Unit, I think it regularly tops the unlivability index of any city in the world. So my expectations were pretty low as it sort of stood. But I remember I arrived at my hotel and they told me, the people in the hotel, to just not leave the hotel almost under any circumstance, certainly not walk on any of the streets. So I couldn't really see much of the city. You know, I took a taxi around, but I saw a lot of crime, a lot of poverty, sort of destitution in some places. And I think, given that when people think of Papua New Guinea, you maybe think of sort of rainforests and local cultures, at least in the capital. There definitely is that in the rest of the country, but that capital is one place I would say that for most tourists, probably skip it. And it is one there where I would say that safety risks are pretty high, so you have to be a little bit careful.
Well, we had a guest on the podcast recently who said that everywhere has something special. I'm not sure you'd entirely agree with this then, would you, Mike?
Well, in this instance, perhaps not, but I suppose there are lessons still to be learned. As someone visiting, I think there's scope for humility when you travel to a place where it is unsafe and people are really struggling everywhere. It makes you feel, I suppose, luckier to have been born in a Western, you know, democratic society. And I know, you know, in the UK we've had our fair share of political ups and downs in the last 10 years. But actually, I think I was traveling at sort of a time of political turmoil, and it was all in my head about all the things that were going on in the UK and how bad it was. And then you travel to other places that have much bigger issues, and you realize how lucky you are. But also, it's a sort of a lesson that, you know, despite the fact that I argue in the book the world is just the best it's ever been and it's improving, there are still places where a lot needs to be done, whereas the vast majority of places, I think, are on an upward curve. And, you know, I was impressed by, there are still places that you go, wow, it's pretty shocking to see how some people have to live. And these are the places where you hope sort of international attention is focused on to help them improve their outcomes.
Evidently, from your book, some of these places are not absolutely top of the list that people might have, and maybe not even great experiences that you would commend. But where are your favourite places?
I think the one that sticks out for me above all else is Japan. And I know that this is quite a common answer, I think, in these sort of questions. Japan, I think it's just fascinating because their culture is so unique. It's a sort of a Western country in the sense of how economically developed it is. It's very wealthy, it's technologically very advanced, but they've kind of said no to a lot of the trappings of sort of Western culture and society. So you arrive in Tokyo and you feel, wow, this is a really quite a different place. And what I love about Japan is on paper is it should not work. Tokyo is 40 million people, so it's four times the size of London. There's no parks. There's not many trees. The buildings are all quite ugly because it was leveled during World War II, so lots of 60s brutalist architecture. So you're not painting this, you know, particularly great image.
Yeah.
But actually, every time I go there, I'm just absolutely sort of beguiled by the place. I think it's the Japanese attention on sort of architecture, interior design, their focus on serving people, whatever job you do, everyone does it with a level of pride. The politeness of the people. So despite the fact you have all these people crushed into this city, because everyone is so polite and courteous, it doesn't feel busy in some places. It doesn't feel overwhelming. And in some places, actually, you walk down these back streets and there's a real feeling of serenity and calm. And for me, I've been to Japan twice, each time for a month. I'm going back in a couple of months on my honeymoon, taking my fiance there for the first time. And it's one of the places where I know I will never get tired of going. So some countries I've been to and I think maybe I'll come back, but maybe that's enough for me. Japan is one I know I will continue going for the rest of my life. And I don't know if either of you have been, but it's just a fascinating culture with amazing food as well, which helps.
I absolutely have been there, and I agree with you 100%. I suppose, though, one would need to say maybe this great sense of order and calm and absence of crime, which is a great thing, represents some kind of regimentation rather than the freedom of the individual. Discuss.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, so maybe it's what's good for a visiting tourist is not necessarily good for the people living in the country. I know that they are there's quite a rigid sort of hierarchical structure. If you work for a business, you know, you treat the CEO as if they're sort of, you know, your superior and you have to defer to them. And I think even part of the reason that I think drinking is a bit of an issue in Japan, it's almost like a more extreme version of the UK. I feel like in the UK, we're still a bit emotionally suppressed, and so we all get drunk and that's where we all let it all out. Yeah. And people actually say how they feel in the not most eloquent ways. And in Japan, the society is even more rigid and you really can't express yourselves in certain ways. But then if you go down to, you know, the bars on a Friday night in Tokyo, people are, you know, sort of collapsed on the street wearing their briefcases after work. It's a real sort of war zone in some ways. There's no fights or there's no violence or anything, but I remember seeing that and thinking, you know, could this be because this is their one kind of escape, their one kind of outlet. So yeah, I would agree that I think there's probably, if you live there, there's some difficulties because of that. But the advantages, I guess, to society as a whole is incredibly low crime rates and a pretty well functioning society.
Well, I think this is one of the most comprehensive travel books I've ever read, and you certainly haven't shied away from big themes, world religions and geopolitics. And I think I'm right in understanding that you think that traveling really helps one to understand these sort of vast and complicated historical currents. But there was one thing which I thought might be missing, and I wondered if that was deliberate or maybe I just missed it. And that was the effects of climate change, which you could certainly argue that traveling and tourism is in fact contributing to in quite a big way.
100%. And I suppose I touch on it, but I think as someone who has, you know, flown a lot, I don't think I can be reasonably a spokesperson for that movement, because my actions would imply that, you know, I really value traveling, and I know that it has an environmental impact. I'm a vegetarian, mainly because of the climate impacts, and I offset my flights, but I know that ultimately, you know, travel does have an environmental impact, is the reality. But do I think that the world would be better if we lost travel altogether? And I actually still think that the net benefits to the world of the understanding between cultures, of people being able to visit countries for themselves or being exposed to people from other nations, I think this for me has been one of the main reasons why, you know, we have some conflicts going on at the moment. But the average annual deaths from human violence in wars is a fraction of what it used to be, just, you know, tiny, tiny fraction of what it used to be throughout our history. And I think part of this is because, you know, we can go to these places and see the people and actually realize, oh, well, they're actually like us. And maybe if tourists come to visit their country too, they can meet people from a country that their government says are evil or deemed to be, you know, malevolent in some ways. So I completely recognize that there is this climate impact, but I would hope that in some ways, travel is still a feature of the world going forward. If you envisage a world where none of us left our borders again, none of us met people face to face again, we're limited to just being told by social media, being told by newspapers of what to think about the rest of the world. And for me, that leads to hatred, it leads to wars in extreme scenarios and a lot of global tumult. So it's a balance, isn't it? And I certainly feel some guilt there, as I think anyone that travels does too. And I guess it's up to you to work out how you feel about it. But my feeling is that actually for the future of humanity, travel, seeing other cultures and exposing cultures to each other has to be one of the most important things we do going forward.
Well, turning to the subject of not guilt, but happiness, you've got an entire chapter on it, which begins, incidentally, when you're driving into the heart of Borneo on a rally international expedition with some controversial durian fruit to enliven the journey. These are, they taste like heaven, smell like hell is the one account of them. But you pose in this chapter the idea of, well, why in the West are we not happier? It seems to be that Denmark, which you pick out, one of the richest countries in the world, isn't as happy as it should be, and that wealth in general is not a good predictor of happiness.
Yeah, so I don't want to underplay the impact of economic circumstance on happiness levels. I think having a base level of income certainly protects you from sort of economic despair, which is going to make you, you know, put you in a better position. But what I would say is in the West, we live in the most advanced, wealthiest societies in human history. But, you know, do people seem happy? I think as countries get richer, more people tend to live alone. We become more individualistic. And there seems to be this disconnection that happens when countries become rich. Whereas using Borneo, an example, we lived in a village for a month, about sort of a 10-hour drive from Kota Kinabalu. And on paper, it was a village that had about 200 people. There wasn't electricity. There really wasn't much money at all. And I expected to go and see there and sort of, I suppose, be exposed to despair and suffering. And what instead I was exposed to was this incredible community spirit where all the kids just ran amok in the village together. Everyone, it was like the whole place was one giant family. Everyone knew everyone. Everyone would help out everyone. So, you know, we were helping work, built a kindergarten. And then after that, all the locals would go and build someone else's house and then they would do someone else's. So, you know, they were always helping each other, always looking out for each other. And this level of connection, I think, is just so important to happiness generally. And in some places that might not be economically rich, having this sort of connection to community or even religious purpose, I think can help sort of buttress them against the difficulties of life. And it's, again, I don't want to sound glib and suggest that, you know, in some very poor places, people would be happier in the West. But what I would say is that we in the West are not as happy as we should be, given our economic advantage. And that is, I think, because our societies are becoming more individualistic. And there is this new phenomenon, really, of loneliness. And I think in the Scandinavian countries, which always top, I think it came out again for this year, Finland has been named the happiest country in the world for the last 3 or 4 years. You go to Finland and you're not struck with the sense that this is the happiest country in the world. And I think these surveys, what they also fail to include is things like they look at economic circumstance and lots of other indicators, but simple things like the weather, for example. Obviously, in somewhere like Finland, when in the winter it's dark all of the time, for a lot of people that has an impact. And so you have the Scandinavian countries, which are supposedly the happiest countries in the world, but they have some really high suicide rates as well, which again would suggest that something is slightly amiss here.
Well, I think we're going to have to draw to a close, Mike. But my last question is, where next? 155 countries down. You've even been to North Korea. So where are you going next? And I gather, actually, that it'll be a bit different because your travelling unit has been enhanced, as it were.
Yes, that's right. So most of the travelling I've done has been kind of solo. But I've now got an 18-month-year-old daughter, Rosie, and she, I think, has been to 13 countries already. So she's well on her way, even though she's not going to remember any of these trips necessarily. But we just spent 5 months traveling through Southeast Asia. So I was working remotely and I was there with my fiance, Sophie and Rosie, my baby. And we had a great time. It was what was really special, I think, is the way that children are viewed in that part of the world in Southeast Asia. Sort of in the UK, if a stranger comes to, you know, ruffles your child's hair, I think they're looked at with suspicion, or people just don't do it, they don't feel comfortable doing it. Whereas in Thailand or Vietnam, people would just come over and sort of play with her, ask to sort of pick her up. And I think as a result of that, she's quite a confident little baby because she's had so much interaction with humans from all these different countries. And the lesson she's been taught is humans are friendly, humans are kind, whatever country that you're in. So I think even though she won't remember the trips, my hope is that it's having an impact somehow and somewhere on her development. So I think for now, we just got back from that trip and then we've got a honeymoon in Japan. And then we're not sure, actually. So I think I'm going to leave some of the slightly riskier states that are left on my list, shall we say, for a few years to see if the situation has improved. I think my tolerance for risk has slightly declined, as you can imagine, once you start a family. But the goal to visit every country, I think, is still there. It's more of a lifetime goal than maybe something I expect to do in the next year or two.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts and your adventures with us. Very good wishes for your impending marriage and honeymoon. And if you'd like to read Mike's book, well, you can find it very easily on Amazon. Just search for The Travelling Ape by Michael Mackay Richards. And it's available both as a real book, nearly 500 pages of wisdom, or as an ebook. And if you'd like to share your thoughts about adventures and whether 99% of the world in your experiences are good people, then please, of course, get in touch with us on X, formerly Twitter, at YouShouldHaveBeKey, or go to anchor.fm/YouShouldHaveBeenThere and leave us an audio message. For now, though, from me, Simon Calder.
And me, Mick Webb. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
And me, Mike Richards. Goodbye.